Following program is intended for mature audiences.
They used to bounce messages across the earth. Shows. Everyone in the old world had a show. Do you think there's still somebody out there? Sending shows? Who knows? Those are the planes of silence.
First performed in 1836 in Russia, the play by Nikolai Gogol. Gogol, that's his name, Nikolai Gogol. Google it. Gogol wrote this wonderful satire, wonderful political satire, which is what we have here on Savino Veritas, I hope. And the name of the play, The Inspector General. The Inspector General, that term, that office, is in the news today here in the United States. It's getting ever more difficult to discern the United States from Russia. Now the Inspector General of the United States will be inspecting the FBI and James Comey, who I've been saying for months has really turned the election in the favor of Donald Trump. That's going to be looked at. Anyway, The Inspector General is a satirical play written and performed in 1836 by Nikolai Gogol. It's considered the high point of Gogol's writing for the stage and a masterpiece of dramatic satire. The Inspector General skewers the stupidity, greed, and venality of Russian provincial officials. When it is announced that the Inspector General is coming to visit incognito, Anton, the chief of police, hastens to clean up the town before his arrival. Local officials scurry to hide evidence of bribe-taking and other misdeeds, setting the stage for the arrival from St. Petersburg of Ivan, a penurious gambler and rake, who is promptly taken by the townspeople to be the dreaded Inspector General. Funny. Ivan and his servant, Osip, soon take advantage of the situation with hilarious results. First performed in 1836, the play transcends regional and national boundaries to offer a biting, highly entertaining glimpse of universal human foibles and failings, which, ladies and gentlemen, is the essence of Savino Veritas in Wine the Truth, the fine wine of select gripes. Remember, I may be joking, but I'm never kidding.
Savino Veritas.
Total fabrication.
The gripes of wrath.
Try getting it out. Go ahead.
Two can be as bad as one. It's the loneliest number since the number one.
So great in so many ways. Beautiful, beautiful.
Now we'll sing a lullaby.
Really?
He thinks of nothing but himself. He doesn't think of nobody but himself.
I assume AJ's clean. I hope he's clean, but I assume AJ's clean.
Meanwhile, but he bangs up Russian people up.
Russian people? Who are you talking about, Russian AJ?
I don't know anything.
Listen, he used to call me when I was a columnist. He used to call me when I was a columnist and say, yeah,
look, AJ wouldn't, Howard, AJ wouldn't feel this way.
The girls have no morals.
You know, when you win.
He's out of his mind.
That was a clip from the Howard Stern Show of 2001. Just as an aside, I was on the Artisty, the Fabulous Show on 4 Culture Radio, which is heard every Wednesday evening. You could catch that live every Wednesday evening on 4 Culture Radio. It is, of course, archived along with this show, Savino Veritas, Cattolo Chronicles, The Velvet Steel, and The Artist D and Anne Marie. All those shows are archived on the Too Cool for School website, juicedtalk.com. But last night I was talking to Dee about the unintended prophetic quality of Dead Air, which was a 1970s comedy radio show featuring Frank Cattolo and myself. And we had a regular character on that show called Dusty the Cameraman, who thought the radio show Dead Air was, in fact, a television show. And we just humored him, and he went around and filmed the radio show. And in a way, it was a prophetic aspect. It was a prophetic vision. Again, we didn't intend it to be. But radio shows are often filmed or recorded in video and shown. Perhaps one of the first to do that was Howard Stern. Now, that clip I played for you, the audio clip, was Howard Stern. And we could see on the screen Howard Stern, Robin, his sidekick, and a man who was a columnist named Al, and I don't remember his last name now. But anyway, Al was a columnist at the time. This was 2001. Now, on the phone, as you could hear, was the infamous Donald J. Trump. The columnist was saying how Trump would call him at all hours of the night from Russia. Now, this is 2001. Trump would call him at all hours of the night from Russia with two women in a hot tub and kind of boast about his sexual exploits at the time. Now, it wasn't mentioned, and nothing was mentioned about, although a hot tub was involved, there didn't seem to be any other water sports involved. But certainly, we all know Trump's unctuous quality of being a womanizer, and certainly in 2001 there was no difference. And in 2001, according to this little clip from the Howard Stern Show, from Russia, Donald Trump was proud and happy that the women had low morals and that he had a lot of money. You're listening to Savino Veritas. This is Tom Savino, live from Burbank, California, land of make-believe and fantasy. And never before have I desired to delve into the world of fantasy as since November the 8th, 2016. Many people are suffering. Doctors are reporting significant illnesses of people who have anxiety and are depressed, and understandably so. If you are awake, you are certainly feeling things, and if you are a supporter of Donald Trump, you are simply not awake. Sorry, you could give me 1,000 reasons that you believe to be true as to why I'm not being fair to you, but you are not awake, friends. You are not awake. Now, on that note, I would like to play you a cut of one of my favorite commentators, Keith Olbermann. Now, Keith is usually very angry, understandably so, and very loud and yelling on his video cast, The Resistance, which can be seen and heard on GQ website, Gentleman's Quarterly. And I totally recommend it. But we're going to play you this one from Keith Olbermann from The Resistance, where he is trying to talk convincingly and calmly to a Trump supporter. No yelling. Here's Keith Olbermann with no yelling about what you should do, Trump supporter, to turn this disaster around before it's too late.
So you support Donald Trump. I'm not going to yell. I'm not going to say you're wrong. I'm not going to talk about his policies. I'm not going to talk about his promises. I'm not going to talk about whether he's going to cut your taxes or raise them. I'm not going to talk about whether he's going to make America great again or crash it and burn it. And unlike what you probably think, I'm not trying to get the election overturned. I'm not trying to get Hillary Clinton into the White House. I'm not claiming the Republican Party won't be there for at least the next 4 years. No, this is about him and you. And the respect for you I start with because you're watching this. You are thoughtful enough to have gotten this far. Frankly, I don't know if I could watch your video. So let's go in on the assumption that you're smarter than I am, in which case you already know what my point is going to be. I don't know who the political figure would be if our places were reversed. I guess the time I ever got the closest to the position you are in was with John Edwards, who had a problem, and I didn't see it. And while he was not my first choice, I would have supported him for president. He had what I thought was a great, humane set of policies, and he had a wife who was so smart and had been through so much in life that she probably should have been the candidate instead of him. And then it turned out John Edwards was a con man who had not only fooled me, he had also fooled her, too. If Edwards wasn't my version of this, it would have to be Anthony Weiner. I used to have him on my TV show a lot. He gave straightforward, damn the torpedoes kinds of answers you never get from politicians. He disliked the same Republicans I disliked, and he hated the same Democrats I hated. And even after he crashed and burned the first time, and then he tried to run for mayor of New York, I thought, well, he has to have gotten that problem fixed, and he might be a really good mayor. And then it happened again. In fact, it had barely stopped. And the next time I saw him, a year ago, I literally was afraid to shake his hand in case, A, somebody took a picture of it, or B, in case whatever he had, it was catching. So I have not been where you are right now, but close. And you are in a terrible position. A man whose opinions you agree with has been elected president and is about to be sworn in, and yet I'm pretty sure you know the problem here. You're smart, and generally speaking, the only person who can fool you is you. You're smart enough to recognize something I saw when I first met this man 33 years ago, and that is this. There is something really, really wrong with him. Who does this on Christmas Eve? His tweet was a plug for a documentary about him. Not even a new documentary, a repeat. Who does this on Christmas Eve? His Christmas greeting on Twitter was just a photo of himself, not the family, not the wife, not the kids, not even the vice president, not Santa, not Jesus, just him. Who does this? 2 days later, meaning 49 days after the election is still all he was tweeting about. President Obama campaigned hard and personally in the very important swing states and lost. What kind of man does this? You win? You act like you've won before, you don't waste your energy on the guy who's gone in a month anyway. Maybe if you're a good guy, you're gracious in victory, you're a good winner, at least during the holidays. Happy New Year to all, including to my many enemies and those who have fought me and lost so badly they just don't know what to do. Love. Would you write that? Would you write that when you got votes from fewer people than the other candidate? Did? Would you call everybody else your enemy? Okay, maybe just because when I interviewed him when I was 25 and he owned a football team and I came away muttering to my producer, what's wrong with that guy? Maybe I'm still wrong. Maybe there's nothing really dangerous about a man who has to tell you how much he won by again and again and again when he actually didn't win by very much. Maybe that doesn't matter. Maybe from where you sit, it's only about make America great again and America first and always defending this country because we are right and we need to be loyal to our great nation. Vladimir Putin said today about Hillary and Dems, in my opinion, it is humiliating. One must be able to lose with dignity. So true. Great move on delay by V. Putin. I always knew he was very smart. Who defends a Russian dictator ahead of an American president, any American president, or an American politician, or half of the people in America? I mean, when he was president, as much as I hated George W. Bush, I never took Vladimir Putin's side against George W. Bush. Would you do that? Maybe you would. I said I wouldn't yell. I'm not going to. To my mind, it is possible for you to agree with Donald Trump and still be a good person. I just disagree with you. But I don't think you're my enemy. But let me run one last pair of tweets past you and ask you if you think they were written by a normal guy. Various media outlets and pundits say that I thought I was going to lose the election. Wrong. It all came together in the last week, and I thought and felt I would win big, easily over the fabled 270, 306, when they canceled fireworks. They knew, and so did I. So those tweets are from last Monday. That means it had only been 3 weeks since he got up at one of those victory tour stops. This one was in West Allis, Wisconsin on December 13th, and he said he thought he was going to lose the election, and he thought he was going to lose the election on the night of the election. Quote, I go and see my wife. I say, baby, I'll tell you what, we're not going to win tonight because the polls have come out. I always used to believe in those exit polls. I don't believe in them anymore. I said, if we're going to lose, I don't want a big ballroom. There aren't a lot of choices here, are there? I mean, he either lied in the tweets or at the tour stop in Wisconsin or to his wife that night, or he forgot that he said it, or there's something wrong with him. To pretend that there isn't something wrong with him, you have to pretend really hard. And I know you can't say it, I know you don't want to believe it, and I know you won't believe this either, but I wish it were not true. But we have elected a man who is not all there. And that cannot end happily for anybody. His illness, and it is an illness, is putting you at risk, and your family at risk, and your kids, and my family, and everybody we know, the ones we like, and the ones we don't. Don't say anything, don't do anything. I don't even want you to admit anything to anybody except to yourself. But you know that someday, probably soon, something bad will happen, and whatever he does will make it worse, and it will all be clear that he's not healthy enough to be the president, and they will have to remove him. And by the way, it will be the Republicans who will have to remove him, either the vice president and the Speaker of the House using the 25th Amendment, or the Republican congressman and the Republican senators impeaching him. Because this isn't about what he believes in. This is about the fact that he's not well. So all I'm asking, all that this video has been about, is for you to just think about it for when the time comes, because when the Republicans really need to remove him as president, they will need to do it in a hurry. And as a Republican, or as a conservative, or as a Democrat, or as an American, or whichever way you describe yourself, it will be a lot easier and a lot safer for all of us if you have prepared yourself and you help them remove him. Because he is not well. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Keith Olbermann, for that piece and all your wonderful regular pieces of The Resistance. Keith Olbermann's Resistance. Resist, everyone. What else can we do? If you accept this insanity, you are either asleep or insane. You're either asleep or insane. So I hope you're not insane. And if you are asleep, I would like to wake you up. People like Gogol, who tried to wake up the people in Russia. Satirists and comedians are trying to help the people wake up here and trying to help people get through this, and trying to get through it ourselves, trying to help ourselves and others get through this. Now, on that note, satire and fake news. The LA Times has a wonderful piece just on that subject. Can satire be seen as fake news? Well, you know, on this show and a little in this episode, you're going to hear a little bit later, Sal Manila, with The Truth, The Half-Truth, and Nothing of the Truth newscast, a satirical newscast. And I hope it's, you know, I hope the humor helps you get through the truth of the insanity of this nation, insanity of this world. But the essayist in the New York Times, who wrote the article that I'm about to read to you, wrote the essay, Is he saying that we are going too far, the comedians, the satirists are going too far, and that we are actually creating Donald Trump? Early on, before he was named the Republican candidate for president, I joked and joked and joked about Trump. But when he won, I started thinking, did I contribute in some way to his winning by publicizing his name all the time? I still have problems with that, but of course now he has won. If you want to call it winning, by having help from the Russian government win, and FBI Comey now being inspected by the Inspector General, did he win with help from satirists? Well, let's find out. I'm going to read you this wonderful piece from the LA Times. You heard Sal Manila on this program and on many Savino Veritas programs. Sal Manila, of course, is our anchor, our news anchor of Veritas News. And we start the Sal Manila segments with the, because the Sal Manila always goes bacterial, but we start the Sal Manila segments with the introduction from the announcer. The introduction is Veritas News, the truth, the half-truth, and nothing of the truth. And of course, it is satirical, as most of this show is, I hope you realize, satirical. Nevertheless, it deals with real things and real news. Sunday, January 8th, 2007 edition of the Los Angeles Times. In the op-ed section, there is a good article by Stephen Mart. The article's title is Left-Wing Satire a Form of Fake News? In the waning days of 2016, liberal late-night hosts took to meeting with their counterparts in the conservative entertainment complex. The Daily Show's Trevor Noah argued with the Blaze's Tommy Lahren about the nature of race in America. Full frontal Samantha Bee interviewed right-wing radio host Glenn Beck for a summit on, quote, nonpartisan decency, end quote. The power of these segments, supposedly, was the reconciliation of unlikely opposites. But how opposite have these two groups really been? The post-truth condition in which Trumpism has flourished has its roots in left-wing satire. 2016 was the year when the line between parody and reality blurred to the point of vanishing. Fake news spread through social media as swiftly as it did thoroughly. By the end of October, a PPP poll found that 40% of Donald Trump's supporters in Florida thought Hillary Clinton was, quote, an actual demon, end quote. Now, 40% of Donald Trump supporters in Florida thought Hillary Clinton was an actual demon, end quote. Post-fact life is funny, but not ha-ha funny. Everything has become a joke, and so nothing is anymore.
I don't think that's funny.
But satire swallowed the news first. The point of origin was probably Jon Stewart's legendary appearance on Crossfire in 2004, in which he claimed that the high-volume political debate program was existentially evil rather than in error. Quote, it's not so much that it's bad, it's hurting America, end quote. When the hosts brought up Stewart's softball questioning of political figures, he used satire as an alibi. Stewart said, quote, my point is this. If your idea of confronting me is that I don't ask hard-hitting enough questions, we're in bad shape, fellows, end quote. Stewart put himself in an ideal position. He was moral arbiter who could determine who was hurting America while he took no responsibility himself. He knew better than journalists, but he was not subject to their rules. He was just an entertainer.
but he wasn't. While Crossfire soon died, The Daily Show went on to become as regular a source of news as USA Today. In 2009, a Time magazine poll declared Stewart the most trusted news anchor on the air. The Daily Show, and those who emerged from it, indulged a contempt for real media institutions while effectively competing with them. In 2010, Stewart led the rally to restore sanity in Washington, an overtly political act. The comedy politics confusion isn't unique to the United States. Beppe Grillo began as a political satirist and now leads the Five Star Movement in Italy. In 2013, the United Kingdom Independent Party was the second most popular party in the Italian Chamber of Deputies. Real power brings with it the problems satirists love to mock, though. In December, the Five Star Movement had to disown Virginia Raggi, the mayor of Rome, when one of her advisors was arrested for alleged corruption. In one sense, of course, political satire is the opposite of fake news. Satirists rip away the pretenses of journalism to reveal what they believe to be true. Fake news sites use the pretense of journalism to spread what they know to be false. Despite intentions, however, the effect is the same. Political satirists and their audiences have turned the news itself into a joke. No matter what the content of their politics, they have contributed to the post-factual state of American political discourse. I'm going to read that sentence again. No matter what the content of their politics, they have contributed to the post-factual state of American political discourse. It doesn't matter what Samantha Bee or John Oliver say. It matters that their comedy is the source of political information. Satire, like fake news, creates a sense of community through rejection. Satire, like fake news, creates a sense of community through rejection. It delights in tearing down institutions, but it's useless at constructing them. Jonathan Swift said that satire was a mirror in which viewers discovered everybody's face but their own. Its pleasure is the pleasure of othering. The act is inherently tribal as well as political, and social media exacerbates the tribalism. Left-wing friends eagerly post John Oliver's latest screed with this, THIS, in all caps, hoping for mutual virtue signaling. Right-wing friends post Pizzagate fantasies to prove how deep their anger runs. The actual content is more or less irrelevant, at least beyond which side is the object of derision. In a recent survey by Pew Research, 14% of respondents admitted they intentionally shared fake news. The left and the right in America are on a contest of competitive virility, comic bits versus fake news. In 2016, the power of outrage mockery was vastly greater than the power of informed debate. But the immediate crisis of American political satire in the Trump era is more basic. It's simple, really. Trump benefits from being satirized. The greatest modern expression of American satire, Spy Magazine, mocked Trump for its entire run. Spy teased Trump for having small hands long before Marco Rubio did. Their contempt only aided his manic self-promotion. The same is unquestionably true for the current Trump parodies on Saturday Night Live. In the New York Times, Alec Baldwin acknowledged that his performances of Trump run the risk of humanizing him, if only that were nothing more than a risk. Parodying Trump is at best a distraction from his real politics. At worst, it converts the whole of politics into a gag. The process has nothing to do with the performers or the writers of their choices. Trump built his candidacy on performing as a comic heel that has been his pop culture persona for decades. It is simply not possible to parody effectively a man who is a conscious self-parody and who has become president of the United States on the basis of that performance. Where does this state of affairs put comedians now? On one side are the engaged comics like Samantha Bee and John Oliver, who are becoming increasingly indistinguishable from straight political commentators, shouting their arguments with an occasional comic aside. Ironically, they look and feel increasingly like a liberal version of Crossfire. On the other side are the comedians of Retreat, Jimmy Fallon chuckling over lip-syncing celebrities and carpool karaoke with James Corden. Trump wins either way. He wins if he's a punchline, and he wins if he's ignored. That's what you get when you elect a walking, talking joke.
Pew, 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 pew.
So Samantha Bee, John Oliver, these people are being seen now and being looked at and put on the status of straight news commentators. You know what I would like to see, though? And we have Anderson Cooper, so we do have a gay news commentator, although he's actually not a commentator, he's a news person. I'd love to see like a transsexual news show. I would watch that. I think that'd be great ratings, a transsexual news show. I'm going to look into that. GoFundMe, everybody. Go fund yourself, everybody. This is Savino Veritas. This is Tom Savino from Burbank, California, land of make-believe and fantasy. And speaking of the truth, the half-truth, and nothing but the truth, here is Sal Manila with the news.
Truth, the half-truth, and nothing but the truth. Veritas News, now with Sal Manila.
Good evening. I'm Sal Manila with the Veritas News. In an unprecedented precedent-breaking move, President-derelict Donald Trump broke precedent today, promising the end of what he called, quote, unnecessary and redundant, end quote, future elections, as well as the end to the executive branch's four-year term limit, creating, it seems, the unprecedented precedent-breaking move to have America become unprecedented and proceed to form a monarchy, a kingdom, in which he will receive all proceeds. In keeping with his own precedent, and despite aides pulling one of his tweets with an apparent spelling error, President derelict Trump did not admit misspelling the word unprecedented, but says that his declaration to move the nation's government from Democratic Republic to a limitless term of royal reign proves he meant to use the word unprecedented. In a related story, the problem of securing noteworthy and famous acts for his inauguration has become solved by royal declaration transforming it into a coronation. President derelict, Air Trump's spokesperson Kellyanne Conway said Steve Bannon will be given the job of ordering Beyonce, Celine Dion, and the Beatles, including the previously thought to be dead John Lennon and George Harrison, to appear. In an ingenious, unprecedented stroke of insight, the unprecedented Trump has hired what's left of ISIS as henchmen, given the task of beheading any celebrity refusing to perform at the coronation. In a symbolic show, President derelict Trump ordered the beheading and public exhibition of multiple-time Oscar-winning but overrated actress Meryl Streep, ensuring, as he said, quote, the most famous of the famous will appear at my coronation, end quote. In yet another instance exhibiting President Derelict's Russian ties, Trump condemned the male-dominated bank protest group Occupy Wall Street and the female-oriented Putin protest group Pussy Riot. But in a precedent-breaking move, the President Derelict combined the two groups, which will now feature sex acts of male domination over the females for Air Trump's viewing pleasure, in a group he now calls Occupy Pussy. Plans to have the group perform their sex act at his January 20th coronation have been met with mixed approval. This has been Sal Manila with the Veritas News. Now back to Savino Veritas with Tom Savino.
Truth, the half-truth, and nothing of the truth. Veritas News. Veritas is satire spelled backwards. With a V for victory.
It's the fabulous game show.
All tied up, ready for...
Veritas is satire spelled backwards.
The most unique array of broadcasters in the universe are on JuicedTalk.com. JuicedTalk.com. You could hear the Fabulous D Show. That's the artist D's fabulous show. You could hear Cotolo Chronicles. You could hear this show, Savino Veritas. You could hear Velvet Steel. You could hear Up All Night, one of my favorite shows. You could hear them all. And you don't have to sift through thousands of yucky podcasts. So, friends, listen to Savino Veritas and all the other wonderful shows on JuicedTalk.com. I hope you enjoy the Sal Manila broadcast. The Sal Manila segment was taped before the news of the famous dossier, which has made quite a splash, so to speak, around the globe. It is that the news has just, that news of the golden showers, and whether it's fake or not, has made quite a splash, and it was quite a big leak, and it's especially big in Germany, Italy, France. It's a really big story if European. So let's get to some facts about this story and see just what I have. Two things to tell you. It's unverified, it's debunked, but there are actually parts of the story that are verified. And then there's a history of how it all came to be. So let's delve into that right now. There's an article from Pajiba, P-A-J-I-B-A, and the New York Times. This is from Pajiba. P-A-J-I-B-A, Pajiba, written by Dustin Rowles. The intelligence that has been verified is nearly as damning to Trump as the golden showers claims. Yeah. By the way, when Trump says, it's my number one priority, now we know what he's talking about. I'm not sure that what BuzzFeed published last night is going to be good or bad in the long run. It certainly provided us all with an entertaining night of urine jokes, and whether the claims that Trump had paid prostitutes to pee on a hotel bed once slept on by the Obamas is verified or not, the perception is going to stick for years, for 4 years. That is going to be part of Trump's legacy, and every raving tweet he posts on Twitter will receive 100 golden shower jokes. On the other hand, what BuzzFeed did was very much confuse facts that were already potent. What has been verified, I'm afraid, may get lost among all the more salacious information that hasn't been verified, nor will probably ever be verified. In fact, it was CNN who broke the original story last night. I covered it here, but minutes after I published it, the BuzzFeed story ran, which left me struggling to update our story, trying to be careful to separate what had been verified and what had not. Let's break this down. Here's what has not been verified. BuzzFeed published a 35-page dossier compiled by a famous British intelligence agent who now runs a private intelligence gathering firm that alleges extensive ties between Donald Trump and the Russians, collusion, blackmail, bribes, kickbacks, and salacious allegations about Donald Trump's sexual preferences, including golden showers and horn. Now, if we separate the dossier with the rest of the story, here is what has been verified. 1. John McCain saw the dossier and was, quote, sufficiently impressed by the source's credentials to feel obliged to pass them to the FBI, end quote. He apparently had a face-to-face meeting with FBI Director James Comey to discuss it. 2. The intelligence community thought enough of the dossier to brief both President Obama and President Trump on it. The allegations were compiled in a two-page synopsis presented to Trump by Director of the National Intelligence James Clapper, FBI Director James Comey, and CIA Director John Brennan, and NSA Director Admiral Mike Rogers. 3. The man who compiled it, contrary to original reports coming out of the BuzzFeed story, is not verified. He's a former MI6 agent, quote, whose past work U.S. intelligence officials consider credible, end quote, according to both CBS and CNN. According to an official who spoke to The Guardian, the former MI6 agent, quote, is consistently reliable, meticulous, and well-informed, with a reputation for having extensive Russian connections, end quote. In other words, this intelligence agent has provided information in the past that has proven to be accurate, and he has well-placed sources within Russia. 4. The dossier contained at least some claims that were subsequently verified. In it, for instance, the British former intelligence officer reported that in July, Carter Page, a businessman named by Trump as one of his foreign policy advisors, met with one of Putin's lieutenants. That information was proven true by U.S. intelligence officials 2 months later. However, the intelligence officer reported that Trump's campaign had knowledge of the DNC's hack over the summer and, quote, had agreed to sideline Russian intervention in Ukraine as a campaign issue, end quote, if the Russians would release it. A few days later, Trump did indeed suggest that he might recognize the Russians' annexation of Crimea. Moreover, despite having little input into the Republican platform at the convention, Trump did insist that certain pro-Russian positions were added. That's an important part, friends. I'm commenting on this paragraph I just read. Remember that in the writing of the platform for Trump's platform during the summer for the convention, the Republican National Convention, he insisted that these pro-Russian items be put in the platform. I remember that. I hope you do too. I hope a pro-supporter, a pro-Trump supporter, will remember and think of that too. Next, the intelligence agents who compiled this information was originally asked to do so by Republicans who didn't want Donald Trump to win. After the primary, the intelligence continued to be collected for the Clinton campaign. All of it was intended to be oppositional research. However, the intelligence professional was so alarmed by what he learned that he sent it to the FBI. Next, Russia had this information and did not release it, though they did release everything they had on Hillary Clinton. Next, in October, the FBI requested a warrant to surveil four members of Trump's team who were suspected of colluding with the Russians. The warrant was denied. However, according to another different report that hasn't been verified, the FBI was eventually granted the warrant in late October. We do not know the results of that investigation, and James Comey just yesterday refused to comment on whether an investigation is ongoing. He has a way of not commenting on things other than Hillary Clinton's emails. Next, Donald Trump's actions have been consistent with the actions of a person who knows he could be blackmailed. He has praised Putin repeatedly, and he has endorsed pro-Russian policies, even though his positions are at odds with both his own political party and most of Americans. Politically speaking, there is no earthly reason for Donald Trump to take sides with our chief geopolitical enemy. Taken together, there is plenty enough circumstantial evidence to suggest that Trump's actions are consistent with the man who has been blackmailed by the Kremlin. There is verified evidence suggesting collusion. There is every reason to believe that the Russians have compromised Donald Trump and that his positions on Russia have been shaped and will continue to be shaped by the leverage Putin has over him. This sets the stage for some potentially very dangerous foreign policies. That's the end of the piece. I will add to that, note Trump's choice for Secretary of State. Award-winning friend of Putin, Tillerson, Rex Tillerson. That's just one thing. There is so much evidence. Trump's son quoted and documented and as saying in 2008 just how much business they have in Russia, despite Trump saying yesterday, "We have none. I have no business in Russia," he says. What a liar. What a liar. I hope he gets his comeuppance. I'm Tom Savino, and I'm presenting Savino Veritas in Wine, the Truth, the Whole Truth, and Nothing But the Truth, and the fine wine of Select Gripes. Now, I'm going to play a little cut from NBC News about the psychology of Trump, what KGB Russian operatives look for when trying to land a dupe to help the Russian cause.
At some point, he was co-opted by Vladimir Putin. And that means that he bought into and embraced the dictatorial ideology that was done by a spy master of the KGB. 10 years ago, 20 years ago, there'd be treason trials at this point. But I'd like to bring one point up. Why? Because long ago, there was a guy named Yuri Bizmenov, a KGB officer, and he wrote, this is who the KGB targeted for recruitment. Egocentric people who lack moral principles, who are either too greedy or who suffer from exaggerated self-importance. These are the people KGB wants and finds easiest to recruit. Vladimir Putin went to the Yuri Andropov School of Intelligence. He learned how to manipulate people. And at some point, we need to find out when did Donald Trump's ideology shift from Western capitalism to Russian authoritarianism.
I don't know. The tape just cut off there. Sorry, folks. This is Savino Veritas. We're not soundproof. We're not foolproof. But we are 90 proof. Additionally, this just came out from the New York Times. How a sensational, unverified dossier became a crisis for Donald Trump. I just read you the bits of the dossier that are verified. Now, this is about the whole story from the New York Times. Washington. 7 months ago, a respected former British spy named Christopher Steele won a contract to build a file on Donald J. Trump's ties to Russia. Last week, the explosive details, unsubstantiated accounts of frolics with prostitutes, real estate deals that were intended as bribes, and coordination with Russian intelligence on the hacking of Democrats were summarized for Mr. Trump in an appendix to a top secret intelligence report. The consequences have been incalculable and would play out long past Inauguration Day. Word of the summary, which has also given to President Obama and congressional leaders, leaked to CNN Tuesday, and the rest of the media followed with sensational reports. Mr. Trump denounced the unproven claims Wednesday as a fabrication, a Nazi-style smear concocted by, quote, sick people. I'm going to put in my comment here how ironic it is for Trump to call anything that is against him a Nazi-style concoction when he and his Steve Bannon are Nazis with their Nazi rallies. It has further undermined his relationship with the intelligence agencies and cast a shadow over the new administration. Late Wednesday night, after speaking with Mr. Trump, James R. Clapper Jr., the director of National Intelligence, issued a statement decrying leaks about the matter and saying of Mr. Steele's dossier that the intelligence agencies have, quote, not made any judgment that the information in this document is reliable. Mr. Clapper suggested that intelligence officials had nonetheless shared it to give policymakers, quote, the fullest possible picture of any matters that might affect national security, end quote. Parts of the story remain out of reach. Most critically, the basic question of how much, if anything, in the dossier is true. But it is possible to piece together a rough narrative of what led to the current crisis, including lingering questions about the ties binding Mr. Trump to Russia. The episode also offers a glimpse of the hidden side of presidential campaigns involving private sleuths for hire, looking for the worst they can find about the next American leader. The story began in September 2015 when a wealthy Republican donor who strongly opposed Mr. Trump put up the money to hire a Washington research firm run by former journalist Fusion GPS to compile a dossier about the real estate magnate's past scandals and weaknesses, according to a person familiar with the effort. The person described the opposition research work on condition of anonymity, citing the volatile nature of the story and the likelihood of future legal disputes. The identity of the donor is unclear. Fusion GPS, headed by a former Wall Street journalist known for his dogged reporting, Glenn Simpson, most often works for business clients. But in presidential elections, the firm is sometimes hired by candidates, party organizations, or donors to do political oppositional work, shorthand for OPPO, short for opposition research. On the side, it is routine work and ordinarily involves creating a big searchable database of public information, past news reports, documents from lawsuits, and other relevant data. For months, Fusion GPS gathered the documents and put together the files for Mr. Trump's past in business and entertainment, a rich target. After Mr. Trump emerged as the presumptive nominee in the spring, the Republican interest in financing the effort ended, but Democratic supporters of Hillary Clinton were very interested in Fusion GPS kept doing the same deep dives, but on behalf of new clients. In June, the tenor of the effort suddenly changed. The Washington Post reported that the Democratic National Committee had been hacked, apparently by Russian government agents and a mysterious figure calling himself Guccifer 2.0. That's a Guccifer 2.0, began to publish the stolen documents online. Mr. Simpson hired Mr. Steele, a former British intelligence officer with whom he had worked before. Mr. Steele, in his early 50s, had served undercover in Moscow in the early 1900s and later was the top expert on Russia at the London headquarters of Britain's spy service. When he stepped down in 2009, he started his own commercial intelligence firm, Orbis Business Intelligence. The former journalist and the former spy, according to people who know them, had similarly dark views of President Vladimir V. Putin of Russia, a former KGB officer, and the very tactics he and his intelligence operatives used to smear, blackmail, or bribe their targets. As a former spy who carried out espionage inside Russia, Mr. Steele was in no position to travel to Russia to study Mr. Trump's connections there. Instead, he hired native Russian speakers to call informants inside Russia and made surreptitious contact with his own connections in the country as well. Mr. Steele wrote up his findings in a series of memos, each a few pages long, that he began to deliver to Fusion GPS in June and continued at least until December. By then, the election was over, and neither Mr. Steele nor Mr. Simpson was being paid by a client. But they did not stop what they believed to be very important work. Mr. Simpson declined to comment for this article, and Mr. Steele did not immediately reply to a request for comment. The memos described two different Russian operations. The first was a years-long effort to find a way to influence Mr. Trump, perhaps because he had connections with Russian oligarchs, whom Mr. Putin wanted to keep on track. According to Mr. Steele's memos, he'd used an array of familiar tactics, the gathering of kompromat, or compromising material such as alleged tapes of Mr. Trump with prostitutes in a Moscow hotel, and proposals for business deals attractive to Mr. Trump. The goal would probably never have been to make Mr. Trump a knowing agent of Russia, but to make him a source who might provide information to friendly Russian contacts. But if Mr. Putin and his agents wanted to entangle Mr. Trump using business deals, they did not do it very successfully. Mr. Trump has said he has no major properties there, though one of his sons said at a real estate conference in 2008 that, quote, a lot of money, end quote, was, quote, pouring in from Russia, end quote. The second Russian operation described was recent, a series of contacts with Mr. Trump's representatives during the campaign, in part to discuss the hacking of the Democratic National Committee and Mr. Clinton's campaign chairman, John Podesta. According to Mr. Steele's sources, it involved, among other things, a late summer meeting in Prague between Michael Cohen, a lawyer for Mr. Trump, and Oleg Solondukhin, a Russian official who works for Rossotrudniki Vesto, an organization that promotes Russia's interests abroad. By all accounts, Mr. Steele was an excellent reputation with American and British intelligence colleagues and had done work for the FBI on investigation of bribery at FIFA. Colleagues say he was actually aware of the danger he and his associates were being fed Russian disinformation. Russian intelligence had mounted a complex hacking operation to damage Mrs. Clinton, and a similar operation against Mr. Trump was possible, but much of what he was told and passed on to Fusion GPS was very difficult to check, and some of the claims that can be checked seem problematic. Mr. Cohen, for instance, said on Twitter on Tuesday night that he has never been in Prague. Mr. Solondukhin, his purported Russian contact, denied in a telephone interview that he had ever met Mr. Cohen or anyone associated with Mr. Trump. The president-elect on Wednesday cited news reports that a different Michael Cohen, with no Trump ties, may have visited Prague and that the two Cohens might have been mixed up in Mr. Steele's reports. But word of a dossier had begun to spread through political circles. Rick Wilson, a Republican political operative who was working for a super PAC supporting Marco Rubio, said he heard about it in July when an investigative reporter for a major news network called him to ask what he knew. By early fall, some of Mr. Steele's memos had been given to the FBI, which was already investigating Mr. Trump's Russian ties, and to journalists. An MI6 official, whose job does not permit him to be quoted by name, said that in late summer or early fall, Mr. Steele had passed the reports he had prepared on Mr. Trump and Russia to British intelligence. Mr. Steele was concerned about what he was hearing about Mr. Trump, and he thought that the information should not be solely in the hands of people looking to win a political contest. After the election, the memos, still being supplemented by his inquiries, became one of Washington's worst-kept secrets as reporters, including from the New York Times here, scrambled to confirm or disprove them. Word also reached Capitol Hill. Senator John McCain, Republican of Arizona, heard about the dossier and obtained a copy in December from David J. Kramer, a former top State Department official who works for the McCain Institute at Arizona State University. Mr. McCain passed the information to James B. Comey, the FBI director. Remarkably, for Washington, many reporters for competing news organizations had the salacious and damning memos, but they did not leak because their contents could not be confirmed. That changed only this week after the heads of the CIA, the FBI, and the National Security Agency added a summary of the memos, along with information gathered from other intelligence sources, to the report on the Russian cyber attack on the election. Now, after the most contentious elections, Americans are divided and confused about what to believe about the incoming president. And there is no prospect soon for full clarity on the veracity of the claims made against him. It is a remarkable moment in history, said Mr. Wilson, the Florida political operative. What world did I wake up in? Well, that's the end of the article. The article, by the way, is in the New York Times tonight. And I'm sorry, yesterday, January the 11th. Oh, no, it is January 11th. Yes, yesterday. Duh. It was written by Scott Shane, Nicholas Confessore, and Matthew Rosenberg. So so what kind of world are we living in now? Well, we're living in the world where a lame schmuck president is about to take office. Somebody who has appointed or intends to appoint award-winning friends as to Putin as Secretary of State. When you connect the dots, you get a very, very dystopian look at the world. I'm afraid we are already in that world. It is reality. And this is Savino Veritas, and we will continue to air as long as this demon Trump, is conquered somehow. So this has been Savino Veritas. We're here every Thursday evening, 8 p.m. Pacific Time, 11 p.m. Eastern Time at 148.ca/1. And 24/7 on a Too Cool for School website, JuiceTalk.com. Be with us again next Thursday and listen 24/7 on Juice Talk. Stay strong, stay sane, resist. Remember, I may be joking, but I'm never kidding.
Meeting is adjourned. Oh, I am sorry, sir. I didn't mean to overstep my bounds. You say that.
What?
Meeting is adjourned.
It is?
No, you say that, Governor.
What?
Meeting is adjourned.
It is?
The end. By George, he's got it. It is the end.
No, that'll be all. Just be sure to lock the door behind you on your way out. Good night.